course, particularly in the testimony given in 1968, in February of 68, that 3 days of testimony, there was an impressive buildup during the course of the hearings where people were speaking less and less. Everyone had prepared statements that were published along with their oral presentations, and the oral presentations were stuck less and less strictly to their prepared statements as the testimony got going, and they began in their testimony to respond to what other people had said before them. It's an impressive document. I have the one, again, I would recommend that for everybody's reading. It's dramatic. It's not dry material, to say the least. I identified five major concerns in the testimony, and all of these we will consider separately as we go forth today. These were analytically separable, although they were not separate in individual people's testimony. These concerns include continuity of use and occupancy of the land, the importance of cash compensation for economic development, the resolution of past social ills and full participation in the future, the achievement of self-sufficiency and self-determination, and continuity in cultural integrity. These five concerns permeated the testimony, and we'll go into them in detail now. The first concern was continuity in use and occupancy, the value of the land. This is interesting. Even though the validity of the claims was established by the fact that the Land Claims Act had been brought before Congress, still a great deal of testimony, of a great many individuals testified to their right to use and occupancy of the land. I'll just give one example from the testimony here. John Kleshnikov of Cordova testified, "When I was a boy, my people lived by trapping, fishing, and hunting. There was plenty for all. We had a good living from the land. Alaska is my home, my land. This is where I was born. This is where my people before me lived and their folks before them. They lived here, survived, and were happy. There is no room any longer. We can no longer trap for furs. We can no longer fish or hunt for a living."
Were matters that fell outside the ambit of the proposed claims legislation. Still, it was true that many things that were presented at those hearings were matters that related directly to sovereignty and to tribal status, but it was not intended to be so. One effort to terminate the Alaska Natives was headed off at a later time by the Native leadership. So the fact was that termination was addressed as an issue. It was discarded as quickly as it arose by the leadership of the Alaska Natives. ANCSA was not intended to be, nor was it in actuality, termination legislation. The federal government's relationship with the Native Americans, of whom the Alaska Natives are an integral part, is of the highest legal standing, established through solemn treaties and a series of judicial decisions and legislative actions. It remains intact, though admittedly largely undefined, in Alaska. The Native elders lacked the ability to articulate the use and occupancy of their ancestral lands in the complex terminology of the white man's law. But when they spoke of how they used their land, of how they subsisted on its bounty, and of how they had fought others to protect it, they were actually describing in layman's terms the basis of Aboriginal or Indian title. This was what gave dignity and translated land claims into land rights. Much of the Native testimony addressed the issue of how the lands had been used since time immemorial to demonstrate that these lands had always been theirs and were still theirs at the time of the testimony. Congressmen were concerned as to how assets received from settlement legislation would be used. Some of them confided they had heard horror stories about Indian spending sprees following per capita distributions. Testimony about constructive plans for the use of Settlement Act monies reassured them, and they needed reassuring. They understood, the congressman did, economic development, and they approved of it as an objective. This, after all, was a concept very common in their world. So we spoke about plans for economic development because it made sense and because it was reassuring to the members of the congressional committees. The Tlingit-Haidas had had considerable experience in planning for the use.
The fight that we had during the settlement was everybody was in favor of paying us some money. Walter Hickel, as the governor of Alaska, came on early for $500 million. Money was never the important thing in the effort for our settlement. Land was. Money was necessary. It's great to have money, but whether the appropriation was $100 million or $1 billion wasn't that important to the people. They wanted the land. Then we had the fight of who was going to get this land. That is, there had to be some mechanism to receive the land. Even as late as February of 1971, when Chairman Aspinall and Chairman Haley introduced their version of what the settlement should be, those two powerful men wanted to vest title to land and money in municipal corporations. Thereby, when some white man moved into a city, village, a municipal corporation, he would share just as much as the natives, the real owners of the land. Bear in mind that during the settlement, this was still at the time of
all the meetings and by consensus of the group, I was going to be the one that was going to organize the Tanana Chiefs meeting in Tanana. And so with the help of another organization where I got some money from them, and I was able to hire a part-time secretary, and I'm going to do a little commercial here, the Association of American Indian Affairs helped pay for a secretary and some of the expenses that we incurred setting this meeting up. We sent out letters to all of the villages in the interior. In fact, I think I went far afield. I was sending letters way down in the Bethel area. And we organized it. The village of Tanana got into it. They organized Nuchilawaya, which they set up for in conjunction with our meeting. And we put it all together through a lot of letter writing, phone, being on the phone, and so on. And we, in June of 1962, we held our first meeting. And at that meeting, I was elected chairman of it for the first year. And we covered all of the issues, again, hunting and fishing rights. Of course, the big issue back then was the Rampart Dam. Were they going to, you know, if they were going to build it, what would they do with all the peoples that lived in the area, and you know, how about land and education, employment, you know, who got the jobs in the villages? And I think it probably we still have basically the same problem. And during that time, of course, we didn't have any money, and like I say, I financed most of my activities out of my home and out of my own pocket, the letter writing and so on. And I had my niece was a good secretary, so she helped me out in doing a lot of the letter writing. So during the course of that first year, after we held our meeting there, we sent out letters, we communicated with everybody. We sent out petitions. So we had, we tried to get organized a petition drive to get the president, which we eventually sent to the president. It took us about a little over a year to get all of the petitions out and getting all the signatures that we could, that, you know, we felt we had all these problems, that we were the owners of the land and that we wanted some kind of settlement. And during that first year, 62 to 63, I had the I was about, 29 years old. I'd never been out of the state before in my life. And through the Association of American Indian Affairs, I went back to a meeting with the Secretary of Interior, who at the time was Stuart Udall. And they had a yearly meeting where all of the Indian interest organizations came together and met with him. And so I went.
It's education and jobs. I talked about that, and it still is with me. In fact, with my colleague to my left here, we have spent some time in the field of education, hoping, personally, I believe that it's great. And I give a lot of credit to our young people today who pursue higher education. The truth of the matter is, the statistics tell us that 85% of our young people are not going that direction. They're not going to get into college. If they do, out of the 15%, half of them may succeed. And the other half, some of them go there to find a good mate. We know that's a good idea. Get a real fine wife or a husband and so forth. You know, that's a good place to match mates. Institution of higher learning, they learn better things. But education and jobs, I think, if nothing else, has helped to speed up those two things in our state. It's the ANCSA. Speed up. Not particularly, you know, great improvements and all that, but to speed it up so that our young Native people can pursue higher education if that's their wish, trades, vocational training, industrial training, and jobs, finally. Because you can have all the education that you can get and not have jobs and not be able to bring home bread and butter. You have nothing. You know, that sounds like words out of a book that I read. If you have all the education you need and have not a job, you have nothing. So we must, I think, work towards those goals. Working first of all,